Blog Talk Radio.
It's the Morning Show.
Okay, you want to rehearse it one time before we go in there?
With award-winning journalist Cheryl Smith.
I'm good, but I'm not that good.
Bringing you informative, enlightening, thought-provoking, inspiring, and entertaining talk radio.
Good morning, good morning, good morning. You are tuned in to I Was Just Thinking, and I'm your host, Norma Adams Wade. You know who you are. You are my co-host. And yes, I stole that from Wendy Williams, and we continue to wish her well and recovery. Oh, gosh, I'm just overly excited about our program today, and I will tell you more about it in a minute, but first, let me tell you about my mask. I'm determined to honor the health protocol until the health officials give me the go to not do this anymore, but I am going to remove my mask for now, and when I go back into the world that we live in, I will put it back on when I go to my favorite Walmart and all of those places and the grocery store and all of that. Because like we said from the very beginning, my mask protects you from me and your mask protects me from you. But I'm going to put it aside for now. Guess what? Today, our guest, and I'm going to go ahead and bring this young man in, okay, and if you hear me sniffling, I have an allergy, so I'll be wiping my nose from time to time. Let me tell everybody who this young man is. This is Frank Frazier. Wow. Can I be in the same space as Frank Frazier? He is a Dallas-born a Dallas resident. he was quickly going to correct me on that. A Dallas resident visual artist, but he's internationally known. And when you hear the name Frank Frazier, really soon after that, you're going to hear the word icon. Okay? He is an icon. Now, he was born in Harlem. Kind of spent some time in his early years in Queens, all in the New York area. And then we finally were honored to get him here in the Dallas area some years later. But in addition to being a renowned visual artist, he is a civil rights activist. And guess what? He has found a way to use his art as a way to address inequities, injustices, and to voice his objections to obvious wrongs in society and to bring it to the attention of the rest of us out here. And so he has influenced a new generation of artists who revere his talent and his activism and his counsel and his mentorship. So I introduce to you the inimitable, whatever that word means is good, artist Frank Frazier. Hello, how are you doing, Frank Frazier?
Well, I'm happy to be here with you. I know who you are, and it goes way, way back.
Absolutely.
But before you did anything, I heard you mention someone. You said Wendy Williams.
Right.
The relationship with her goes way back, because I used to do a lot of work with WBLS.
Yeah.
Back in the day with my friend Frankie Crocker.
Okay.
I go way back then when I used to do different programs to help raise money for whatever they were doing.
How wonderful. Now, you see how small this world is. You see how small.
The world is real, real small. And I've always been doing what I've been doing. And at some point in my life, it's not about the money. It's about the opportunity to be able to do it. John Lewis was actually a friend of mine.
Okay.
Wasn't just about meeting him. And in fact, right before he died, I took him to New York City to this famous art dealer, and we were discussing on buying these Charles Whites.
Okay.
We had a friend that had like 200 Charles Whites original, and we were trying to get John Lewis to buy them for the Congressional Black Caucus.
Okay.
But then John Lewis made his transition.
Right.
Well, I'm really glad to be here with you because you're one of the real people.
Oh, my
and
gosh.
You know what? I talked to Paula Walker Madison a couple of days ago.
Oh, you did? What? Yes, yes.
And wait a minute. Here's a real interesting part.
Go ahead.
When they did the nappy hair poster, one of the people that contacted me, well, they really didn't contact me. They put it in Facebook, was Charlotte Hunter Goss.
Yes.
I go way back.
Yeah, that's now that she's an outstanding
right. Before she went
journalist
to South Africa to live.
Right.
And there were several people. See, I used to be a member of the Black Journalists, but they got different lately. They're not like they used to be. To me, they're not. So, but I still support them.
Wonderful.
All of them.
Wonderful.
What a lot of folks don't realize, that organization almost came from Dallas.
Okay.
A lot of the founding members were from Dallas.
Well, I am one of the founders of the National Association of Black Journalists, and I am honored. Yeah. I'm honored that you remember that history.
Right. There was another young lady that left, and she went to, she went to Louisiana.
Okay. Okay.
I don't remember her name.
Okay. Okay.
But, I try to keep up with some of them. You know, we get my next birthday. I'll be 80.
Wow.
I'm old.
That's...
I like being old because I know the
story. I love that. And you mentioned about knowing Wendy Williams, but that made me think. And audience, let me add this to this profile of Frank Frazier. With him being a renowned international visual artist, let me just add that a number of his illustrations and artwork has been in published books. It has been featured on television shows and in movies. And I ran across a list that showed some movies where some of his art has been included, Waiting to Exhale, Coming to America, the TV show Frank's Place, the movie Bustin' Loose, all of those, some of his art has been included. So he's no one to turn your nose up at.
I've had a great experience. So when you talk about Coming to America, there's more involved in that particular movie. The star of the movie was one of my students.
What's his name?
The star of the movie.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of his name. I'm blanking out on his name. Eddie Murphy.
Eddie Murphy and Chuck D.
Okay, Chuck D. I do.
Went to Roosevelt High School, and that's where I was teaching.
Okay.
So I used to see them every day.
Can you imagine?
Right, and they've been very successful. When Eddie came to town many, many years ago, I went to visit him and all.
Yeah.
But when he was doing the movie about where they were in Harlem. Because you mentioned Coming to America.
Right.
I had to go to that movie on that set to pick up the check.
Had to get the money.
All of night.
Show me the money. Show me the money.
Right. Well, what happened was they were still doing the movie, and Eddie came out, and he hollered out, stop.
Uh-huh.
Everybody looked at him. What the hell did he say stop for? He walked over to me and said, hello, Mr. Fraser.
Oh, wow.
That was probably one of the greatest ego moments.
Oh, I can imagine. Oh, my gosh.
And what's her name was sitting in back of me.
Uh-huh.
What's that lady?
One of the stars of the movie?
Yeah, the lady that's the scene they were done where he shot her in the foot.
Oh, shucks. I know who you're talking about, but we know who you're talking about.
But it's been a wonderful trip, and I'm hoping to make a couple
Della Reese. Yeah.
what a lot of folks don't know, about 2 weeks ago, the set director of that movie, or both of those movies, happened to be a black woman.
Okay.
She was the first black set director in Hollywood. She came to Dallas about 2 weeks ago to see me.
Okay.
I can't think of her name right now. Cheryl.
Okay. But she was the set director of that Harlem movie. Okay.
First black set director.
Okay.
Too.
Okay.
And speaking of movies, I still got some pieces in a new movie, Journey to Jordan.
I
got a couple of pieces in there. I've been blessed.
You got a cold? I do. Well, I have my annual allergies, and every
you feel like you're 29 years old.
Thank you for that. But
well, I play in your ear.
Oh well, that's a wishful thought.
All right, thank you.
But I want to acknowledge our chat. And so, Pete, here's a question already in the chat, and it says, Frank, where can I get your songs to download? That's what the question. It says, where can I get your songs to download? Now, they might have you mixed up with somebody. They might mean your art. They might mean your art.
All they got to do is call 817-868. 2149.
Okay, say it again. We'll put it in the chat. 817. Say it again.
2149.
We'll put that in the chat.
And I live at 1718 Ramsey.
Now, do you really want to give your address? I don't think you want to do that.
Well, I have no problem.
Okay. All righty. Well, now listen. Since we are talking about, and I've got all kind of questions to ask you, and I want to go back to some of your early years, but before we go back a little bit, I want to ask you, at what point, as you look back over your journey, did you begin to realize that people like Eddie Murphy and Wendy Williams and all of those prominent names, when did you look in the mirror and begin to realize that you were out there with these, well, star level people, I guess.
I look at star level people different.
Okay.
People to me that were, you have to look at people that's important in your life or in your movement.
Okay.
And Eddie Murphy and people like this wasn't really that important.
Okay.
It was good that I know them.
Mm-hmm.
The people that were important to me were people like John Lewis.
Okay.
Because they were doing something for the movement. Something I had to deal with life.
Right.
And that's just a whole lot more important.
Well, let me jump in right there. And again, we're going to just kind of float around all over the place.
No problem.
But as I said in the intro, you have found a way to combine your talent, your innate talent, visual talent, sculpting and all of that, combine it to give a civil rights message. When did civil rights begin to stand out
That's
to you?
That's a good question.
Go ahead.
That took a moment.
Uh-huh.
See, I happen to be one of those black men. I ain't got no education. I didn't finish junior high school.
Okay.
So for a while, for me to deal with artists like Romeo Beard and Jacob Lawrence, now they talk these real smart words because I didn't know what they were talking about.
Okay.
So to make me comfortable I started going to Africa. So that way, when I did my artwork, you know, when they start talking about degrees and all that, all I had to talk about was my movement to Africa and how Africa made me do what I'm doing.
So might maybe about what period of time might that have been? The 70s, the 80s, what?
That was the late, the early 80s.
Early 80s.
Exactly when I came to Dallas.
Okay.
When I was in New York and everything, most of my art had to do with the street life.
Street life. Uh-huh.
Right. You know, one of my first big sales that I ever made was in Harlem.
Okay.
My brother pulled up in the prettiest black car in the world. And three black women, finest to be, popped out. And I simply asked them, what'd he do? And they looked at me and said, what do you think he do? He was a pimp. And sometimes we forget that other element of people.
Uh-huh.
So we like art, too.
Okay.
And so I started doing a lot of stuff related to the streets. So you see, I have a different opinion of drug dealers.
Okay.
I don't want them, but see, we all talk about the black drug dealers being all bad and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But yet we all went to see The Godfather.
We did. We did.
We still go see movies like that.
Right.
So all I want my black brothers to do is take their money and put it in the community and build something like the so-called mafia deal. How many of us go to Vegas?
Mm. A lot. A lot.
You can't talk about the brothers bad if you go to Vegas, but you're going to the capital of the bad. So my point is that we need to take the negative and turn it into a positive.
Okay, let me ask you this. Now, you were born in Harlem and you spent some time in Queens. What was the community like?
I was born in Harlem.
Born in Harlem. I'm sorry.
My daddy, by the way, my daddy's name was Padilla, Puerto Rican.
Okay.
That's a whole nother story.
Okay.
My daddy hit the number one day.
Okay.
And we moved to Queens.
Okay.
So all I know, he did well enough. We bought a house and a Chevrolet.
I love it. All I know,
he hit the number. Whatever it was, he hit it pretty big.
Right, right.
And then from there, I left and ran away from home and went to Philadelphia.
Now, why would you run away from home?
Because I was a young man, thought I was in love with this woman.
Okay. Okay.
I hate to call her my first wife, because that sounds so negative. But that's what she was.
Well, it's just a fact. It's just a fact of life. She was your first wife.
And then I joined the military.
Okay.
And then I went to Vietnam. While I was in Vietnam, I did a lot of artwork about Vietnam.
Okay.
And I sent it home, but people didn't realize to keep it. I used to take the sea ration cans and draw on the sea ration cans what was going on in Vietnam.
Wow.
And I'll say today is where I really became a black man was in Vietnam.
Okay, now let's put a pin there in Vietnam. So let's kind of regroup. Born in Harlem, your dad hit the numbers. We don't know what it was, but it was pretty hefty. Moved to Queens, bought a Chevy, I think you said. And yeah. Then you ran away, and then you ended up in the military, and it was during the Vietnam era. Now, I do understand that you've got a purple heart.
I got two purple hearts.
Got two purple hearts. Tell us a little bit about your Vietnam experience. Where were you? Where were you mostly in the Vietnam area?
I was same place where the tech event happened.
Okay. Okay. And
I was an infantry soldier.
And
I watched my whole platoon get wiped out when I came back from the first time I got wounded. I became a real black man in Vietnam because the one thing I realized, these people we were trying to kill were people of color.
Okay, now let me back up because you kind of swept over that. There you were infantry person, you just said you watched your whole platoon get wiped out. Now, that's Mr. Frank Frazier. That had to be an emotional, hard-hitting experience.
I don't want to talk about it so much because it'll make me cry.
Well, and see, and I understand that. I understand that. Mm-hmm.
When I got wounded the first time, if you didn't get wounded bad, they heal you up and send you back. Well, that day that I got back, the same day I got off the helicopter, my platoon was down in the valley, and they just all got killed.
My gosh. Deep breath.
I think about it a lot, but wasn't nothing I could do about it.
Nothing.
But I woke up in Vietnam and realized, man, we killing black people.
Mm.
There's some people in Vietnam that a lot of folks don't know about. A little history for you. Some people call them mountain yards.
Okay.
These are black people. They're darker than me and you by a long shot.
Okay, now you got to tell me about that. This is all educational for me. Okay, in
the French used to come over there.
Okay, wait now. In the Vietnam area, you're saying there are some black people like us, darker than us, and they're called mountain yard people.
Mountain yard people.
Are they still there?
Yeah, they're still there.
Still there? Okay.
The French used to come over there way, way back.
Okay.
The French brought black soldiers and black men, and so they intermixed with the Vietnamese.
Wow.
And that's why we got those darker people.
That's an education. That is an education.
And a lot of folks don't realize Ho Chi Minh was friends of a lot of black leaders.
Okay.
Because of who he was. You know what one of the greatest people in the world that I had to see?
Who?
Fidel Castro. You know where I saw him at?
Where?
Hotel Teresa.
Okay.
You know where Hotel Teresa is?
I've heard it, but I don't remember where it is.
Hotel Teresa was the hotel in Harlem.
Okay.
The other folks down here, they learning stuff as I talk. It was a hotel in Harlem. And you know who used to work in that hotel?
Who?
The negative brother that got killed on the plane.
Mickey Leland? Not Mickey Leland?
Before him. Michelini was my friend, too.
Okay.
I used to go see him and his wife.
Yeah, but I can't think who would have been killed on a plane. Not John Kennedy's son.
He was the first black chairman of the NAACP, not the end of the Democratic Convention.
You know, I can't recall who that was.
They said all kinds of Ron somebody. In my lifetime, and I met people I never. I was from the hood, no education. Man, Bishop Tutu's daughter babysitted for us.
What? Oh my.
Here in Dallas.
Oh my gosh.
It was only for 2 weeks, but me and her became friends when she was at Howard University.
Oh goodness.
I've been blessed. I mean,
you have.
I never met Obama, but I'm gonna tell you real quick about him. I didn't meet him, but his inauguration.
Uh huh.
Wait a minute. At the bar where they had the dinner.
Uh huh.
I had a table.
Okay.
The table cost.
Wait a minute. What did you say about?
It was about $150,000. They gave me a table. I had my wife, whatever crew was working for me then, I had them all with me. Well, a lot of other folks don't know, because sometimes I don't do things the right way. I did the first poster for Obama.
Okay.
My wife was fussing at me for the same reason. So you didn't save any of them? When Nelson Mandela got out of prison, I did the poster.
Oh, my God.
Commissioned by Bishop Desmond Tutu. Daughter commissioned me to do it.
Okay.
My name is Zumba.
Okay.
And sometimes you're so excited about what you're doing, you just forget it. I didn't keep any. I've had a good life. I'm still having a good life.
Let me do this right quick, and this is kind of amateurish, but I printed, I don't know if it'll even show, but I printed out some of you. That's the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and
right.
That's a shot that I just kind of copied. And you, I see you've got art behind you there. This one is, now, I think those are the,
that's the Black Panther.
Black Panther, okay. And then this one, now this,
that's
you are.
That's my old work.
Right, where you are noted for those vibrant colors that you use.
That's my old work.
Right,
old
right. And then this is one, is that the Panthers also?
Yeah, that's the
Panthers. And then, okay, the last, okay, now this is a fairly recent one about Black Lives Matter.
Right. Well, it all fits in. See, the thing about the Panthers is I'm real friends with Frederica Newton.
Okay.
And a brother named David Hilliard.
Okay.
You
okay.
Know
yes, I do.
I call them every now and then to check on.
Okay.
You're doing pretty good, too.
Great. And so, but now how did you get to be friends with the Panthers?
Frederica, well, many, many years ago, I went there to do something with David Hilliard.
Okay.
You know who David Hilliard is.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
He's still a Panther.
Okay.
And so I went there for a meeting they were having,
uh-huh.
Did some artwork or something. And then I developed a relationship with Frederica Newton.
Okay.
She was Newton's last wife.
Right.
And I did a whole series to help raise money for the Black Panther Foundation.
Okay.
Matter of fact, she called me 2 days ago.
Okay.
Asking me to help her. They're getting ready to do something at Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah.
At the film festival.
Yeah.
I wanted to know if I was interested in coming. Right now, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Martha's Vineyard is I've never been there, but it certainly sounds like a place everybody really has positive experiences there.
No.
Not so?
You don't go there if you ain't got no money.
Okay. Thanks for the clarification. Thanks for the clarification.
Don't let nobody fool you.
If
you ain't got no money.
Don't go. All right. I take that as informed advice.
You know, it's expensive there.
Yeah.
Everybody is being cute. And that's all right. You know, we get a chance. And that's all right.
Right.
When folks don't realize to get there, you got to fly into Boston. And then you got to go to this little town, then take a boat to get there.
Wow.
You can't fly in there. You got to take a boat.
Got to take a boat.
You know, Obama and all of them go there.
Right. And I'm trying to think of our Academy Award actress lady. I think she's got property there.
We all got property.
Right.
Paula Walker got a place there.
That is correct.
Paula can
handle it. She can handle it.
And your buddy... The one who used to live here for a while, the reporter.
Dwayne Wickham? Martin. Not Dwayne Wickham.
No, Martin. Roman Martin.
Oh, okay.
His family got a place.
Now, you know what? I didn't even know Roland was there, but Roland can handle it. He can handle it.
You know his sister lives here, right?
Well, I know Roland was here and a former wife is here, but I never met his sister. Okay. But he's out of Houston. Roland's out of Houston.
Right.
Exactly. But now let me ask you this. Now, everybody, let me bring the audience in again. Y'all, we are talking with Frank Frazier. Not only does he live in Dallas, but he's originally from Harlem, but he is internationally known. His art has been in movies and books. And he calls the role of recognized names, but he told us that the names that are important to him are names like John Lewis, who was a friend,
right.
Eddie Murphy, stopped the filming of a movie when Frank Frazier walked on the set, and he walked over and greeted him, stopped the filming and walked over and greeted him. That's how respected this person
names
is.
Names are important, like you.
I'm sorry. I didn't hear it.
Names that are important is your name.
Oh, goodness. Thank you, sir. Thank you,
yeah,
sir.
Every now and then, you know, everybody don't read newspapers like we used to.
Every
time I see a morning news, the only thing I look for is your name.
Oh, thank you, sir.
If your name ain't there, stop looking.
Thank you. Well, now let me move on.
Well,
I want
to ask you.
Go ahead.
Did you pledge
No, no, never went Greek. Never went Greek.
Okay, good. I'll leave that alone.
Yeah, leave that alone.
One of the other things I do, now I am name dropping. I work with Tom Joyner a lot.
Okay, okay.
But the reason I work with him is we trying to raise money for these black kids to go to school.
The HBCUs?
Right, that's mm-hmm. why I used to go on the cruise every year.
Okay.
The only thing I did on the cruise was sell artwork.
Oh, okay.
To help our children. You know, go to school.
Okay, okay, okay.
And he's a good brother, so if he's here, what's up, Tom Joyner?
Now, let me go back to, I understand that you kind of started scribbling images as young as, like, what, 7 or something like that?
Yeah.
Tell us about that. I mean, you remember that? Do you remember sitting?
I got something to show you.
Go ahead.
It just happens to be here right now.
Okay.
Don't fuss at me. Sometimes we don't know no better.
Okay.
You see this cup here?
Yeah, let me see. Hold it up.
See this cup here?
I see the cup.
Your white man's supposed to be Benjamin Franklin.
Okay.
You know how old I was when I did this?
You did that cup of Benjamin Franklin?
I did this cup when I was in what grade, first year, junior high school?
That's about 8th, about maybe 8th grade or so, something like that?
That's when I did this.
And was it a class project or what?
It was a mold. All I had to do was paint it and all.
But, I mean, why Ben Franklin? Why Ben Franklin?
Because back then, he was a fat black man and a white man, fat white man, that I thought did a lot of good.
Okay.
And see, you used to read about him having two people in the print shop with him.
Uh-huh.
See, back then, I didn't realize those two people were slaves.
Yeah, well, yes.
He became my hero, but it's okay, because he guided me to the right way.
Okay, okay. But
this cup is over. This cup is... Damn near, this cup is 62 years old.
My goodness. But now back to you... Back to you picking up a pen or a Crayola or whatever it was back then. What do you remember about that, and how did it touch your soul, if at all?
I remember it well. When I was in elementary school,
uh-huh.
the teachers would have me draw stuff on this plastic piece of paper.
Okay.
You take that plastic piece of paper, put it on the camera, and they shoot it up on the screen.
Okay.
So I started doing that for the whole school, and that's where it started at.
Let's stop there a minute. When the teachers had you still didn't quite get it that they were really noticing your talent. You didn't... You thought they were telling you to do something.
I didn't have to go to all the classes.
Okay.
But you have to realize that I was a young brother coming from Holland,
okay.
Queens.
Uh-huh.
And when I came to Queens, you know, back then everybody thought they were educated.
Okay.
And I met Holland. So I was always trying to prove that I was tough.
Okay.
Because I had curly hair.
Uh-huh.
I wasn't a bad looking young man back then.
Okay.
And I was always trying to prove I was tough. So I'd leave Queens and go to Harlem.
Okay.
Keep going.
Okay.
I kept getting in trouble.
Okay.
So I was trying to prove that I went to a boys' institution and all of that.
So you kind of got a little tough and got in a little bit of trouble there, okay?
I got in a lot of trouble.
Yeah,
they sent me to a boys' institution.
Yeah.
Then I left.
I bet you had to be tough there.
Well, wait a minute. I graduated from the boys' institution to the big boys' institution.
Okay. Wait a minute. What does that mean?
I didn't go to jail, but it was a place called the Annex.
Annex.
It was next door to Armira prison.
I'm glad you didn't.
I was a bad boy.
Okay.
But,
so what turned you around? What turned you around it? Because, you know, that path could have kept going.
At some point, I went before a judge.
Uh-huh.
The judge that ended up being the Attorney General for New York.
Okay.
And the judge said that if you don't go into service or something, you're going to get killed out here.
Wow.
And I didn't have no education. I didn't finish high school, so the Army wouldn't take me.
Okay.
So I had to join what's called the draft. I had to volunteer
okay.
for the draft.
Okay, okay.
I had to ask the draft to draft me.
Okay, but now let me stop you right there. Okay, now at that point, I'm guessing were you still a teenager? Are you in your early 20s or what?
No, I'm still a teenager.
You were still a teenager. Okay, now let me ask you this.
19, maybe.
Okay, about roughly 19. But wait a minute. I want to ask you this. Do you remember in your head saying, now look at here, this judge, this man has already told me if I don't get my act together, I'm going to the big house. Did you intelligently make a informed decision? Because, you know, at 19 or 18, we don't make our best decisions.
Well, no. The decision that I made was that if I went into the service, I know I got a suit.
Uh-huh.
And I got fed.
Okay. That's pretty intelligent.
That was cool.
Okay.
And remember, I'm one of them young black men that grew up with a mother and father.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, when you really think about it, that makes a difference in life back then and now.
Absolutely.
I always had a mother and father. And like my wife said, I always had my own room. I was just trying to be something else.
But wait a minute. Did you have siblings? Or are you an only child?
I had a brother.
So there were the two boys.
We were only 11 months apart.
Okay.
And that's a whole... another story.
Okay.
Remember, I told you my mother's last name and my father's last name is Padilla.
Okay.
My last name is Frazier.
Okay. Well, we're not going to try to figure it out.
And I have good-looking parents.
We're not going to try to figure it out.
Now, I'm going to show you my parents.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm proud of my parents.
All right, now. See, Mom and Dad. So Dad was from Puerto Rico?
No, his father was.
His father was from Puerto Rico. Okay.
I have good-looking parents.
Okay. Well, yeah, they passed it on. You're not bad.
Can y'all see that?
Okay, put it up a little closer.
How you do that?
Okay, angle it down maybe.
Yeah, I'm going to let somebody else.
Okay. Kind of angle it down because it's the light is shining. Oh, okay, there you go. All right. Okay. They're smooth. They are smooth. All right.
My mother worked at Chock Full of Nuts.
What is that?
That's an old restaurant they had all over the country.
Okay.
They still got Chock Full of Nuts coffee.
You know, I have heard that name but didn't know what it was.
Chock Full of Nuts.
My father
worked for the, he was a counselor for the VA.
Is that right? Okay. Well, so did he have education, I guess, or what?
You know what? I really didn't know.
Uh-huh. He had some smarts. He had some smarts.
My mother, when she was working at Chock Full of Nuts,
uh-huh.
she was going to nursing school.
Yeah.
That's all I know.
Okay.
And I still ask her, was her husband... without my real father, I ain't never got an answer.
Okay. Well, you know, some things we don't get answers for.
Yeah, back then they took it to the grave.
Absolutely. That's what family was, you know, and then like...
that's what we were supposed to do.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the way it was. That's the way it was. And you kind of, with you not wanting to talk about certain parts of your military experience, you're being wounded. That's understandable. You know,
I don't mind talking about it.
But it brings you down a little.
Very emotional.
Yes, absolutely. And who wants to deal with that? You know.
I've seen a lot of young black men die.
Yeah.
They didn't have to die.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially when we found out later on what we were really fighting for.
Yeah.
All had to do with money.
Yeah.
You know, in Vietnam, after a firefight was over, we had to go count all the trees.
Okay.
You know why we had to count all the trees?
Why?
The trees produce rubber.
Okay.
And sugar.
Okay.
And whatever, they I don't know how they do it, But they decided they paid that country for whatever they would have produced over the years. And they still pay them.
Money, like you said, all based on money.
Right.
All based on...
Like our president, he gone over there to talk about oil. But the bottom line is, they don't want to mess up that oil.
Yeah.
But once we get these electric cars, it's going to be done.
Wow. So now, okay, let's go to when you came home. And everybody, we're talking with a renowned international artist, Frank Frazier, and he's just
I'm
reviewing.
Just black artist.
What?
I'm just another black
that
artist.
Is not true. Absolutely not true. You you are heads and shoulders. But we'll let you think that. We'll let you think that. We don't think that. We know better. But at any rate, so there you were in service, and you used your art in service, and then you came home. So what went through your mind? Now, you spent a lot of,
I didn't come home like everybody else.
You were wounded.
Exactly.
You were wounded.
When I came home, I stayed in Valley Forge Hospital, Pennsylvania. I stayed there for about a year and a half.
Wow.
I'd come home on the weekend once I was able to walk and everything.
Wow.
And I saw all the negatives about Vietnam.
Yeah.
But remember, they had no education or nothing. So when I got out of the service, the only job they offered me was, and I passed the test, was the post office.
Okay.
I didn't want to be in another uniform.
Right.
At least not that uniform.
Right.
I wanted to be a police officer, but my arm was too messed up.
Okay.
So I got I lied and told this company that I could do anything.
Okay.
So they made me a salesman.
Ah.
And I ended up working for one of the biggest companies in the world.
What?
I ended up working for Nestle.
Yeah, let me see. I forgot Nestle. What Nestle's is. Is it candy? I can't remember. I know Nestle's. What is
coffee.
Nestle? Coffee. Okay. Yeah. I thought it was some kind of candy.
Yeah, that's what I sold, the candy.
Okay. Okay.
Before I went to Nestle, I worked for H.J. Hines.
Okay.
In Minnesota.
Okay.
As a salesman.
Okay.
And that's what helped me get what I got. Well, then eventually I moved to Long Island.
Okay.
And I opened up a art gallery.
Now that's what, now put a pin in that right there. Put a pin right there. Here you are, you're back home. You went through these various jobs, salesman, post office. Well, you didn't want to do post office. And then you went to Long Island, and that's when you opened an art gallery. Did I hear that correct? Okay, so that tells me then that when you came home, you still had that art part of you somewhere within you. You had used it in the military and all like that. What?
I was doing the art while I worked for a candy company.
Okay.
I kept saying in my head, man, I want to do this forever.
Okay.
And to be honest with you, that's why me and my first wife ended up getting a divorce.
Okay.
So I came home one day and said, I'm doing my art full time.
Uh-huh.
He said, you crazy? See, back then, in 1971, 72, I was making, back then, I was making about $450 a week.
Wow. That's
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
And I also had a company car each year.
Wow. Wait a minute. I kind of have to put a little pause in that myself. When you come home and you announce to the missus, I'm giving up all this, $450 per week company car, and I'm going to do art full time. I kind of look at you cross-eyed, too.
Right. That's what happened.
I can believe it. But how did you make that decision? What inside of you?
I went and did an art show in a place called Mr. Connecticut.
Okay.
I made $400 that week.
Okay.
That was it.
You thought, okay, here's some income right here. Can do this, and I like doing it.
Right.
Okay.
It didn't work like that.
Oh, okay.
I remember what she said to the day. She said, well, how are we going to pay the bills?
Yeah.
I said, late like we've been doing. And that was the end of the relationship then.
Oh, gosh. Oh.
Now, I understand. You know, I understand how feelings.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But, I mean, it was a gradual thing.
Yeah.
Because when I quit the job, we still was married.
Yeah.
I was working in the school system. That's how I met Eddie Murphy in there.
Okay.
I was working in the school system and running a museum.
Oh.
And it was more fun running the museum.
Okay.
Hard-wise.
Okay, but now tell me about the school system part. How did that come in?
I started the museum, the gallery.
Yeah.
And the school system asked me to be artisan resident. I didn't even know what they were talking about.
Okay, okay.
They said yes.
Okay. Okay.
I knew they were going to pay me back then. They were going to pay me $75 an hour.
Okay, okay.
That sounds like heaven.
That did.
But see, I didn't realize you don't get that every day for a year.
Okay.
You get it only the day, but it still sounds like heaven.
Okay.
So and then I got a divorce.
Yeah. And so, but you kept doing the gallery, I'm assuming.
Yes.
And so what was your next step? When did it begin to catch hold?
It always did.
It okay.
I was happy. I was happy inside.
Uh-huh.
And being happy inside makes you feel real good.
You know, that's that old saying, if you find something that is your passion, you never
exactly.
work a day in your life because you're doing something.
Good.
Yeah, yeah. Hmm.
I mean, real good.
Hmm.
And sometimes I make it, sometimes I didn't.
Hmm.
And the ex-wife, she understood, you know, this is this man's best.
Yeah.
We were still friends to the day she died.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I'm talking about real friends.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Even my wife now, Judy,
mm-hmm.
when she was going to New York, she was staying at the ex-wife's house.
That's interesting. Now, that's how it ought to be. That really is how it ought to be.
We were friends.
Yeah, yeah.
I know what they did. They just sat up there and talked about me.
I know they did, too. I wasn't there, but I know they did.
I've been blessed. Okay.
But now, go ahead.
It's time, but I got about another 10 minutes. I got to get off.
Okay. Very good. Well, okay, now before we, let's begin to wrap up. What is the message that you feel your artwork portrays? What are you seeking to tell the rest
truth.
Of us?
Simply to tell the truth.
Okay.
And to me, in the art world, it's important that artists do something related to what's going on in the world.
Okay.
Not just their life, the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I try to do.
Yeah.
And I don't try to give any great advice to any other artist.
Mm-hmm.
All I tell them to do is what makes them feel good.
Okay.
Or make more so than feel good, feel comfortable.
Yeah. Yeah. Any memorable art pieces? Now, you showed your cup of Benjamin.
Like all my art.
All of it. Do you ever destroy art that you just said,
never.
Never. Never. Okay.
I've done some stuff that was ugly. I still like it.
Okay. That's very good. Very good. Now, the way people can reach you, we'll put it in the chat, and we have your email address, which is visions, visions@swbell.net. That's your email. Let me say it again.
They do better calling me or texting me on the phone.
Okay.
I don't like that.
You don't like that, all that email stuff. Okay.
I don't like the computer at all.
Okay, and then
I'm only doing this because of you.
Oh, thank you, sir. And the phone number you said is 817-368-2149. Okay. And let me just tell the audience, if you really look up Frank Frazier on social media and on the web, I should say, on the web, and there's lots of displays of his artwork on the web, and it's overpowering because it does give.
Let me stop you a minute. You made me think. You want to know one of the greatest shows I did?
What?
Little Rock, Arkansas.
What happened? What happened?
I just did a show there.
Okay.
Little Rock, Arkansas. Remember, all the things we heard about Little Rock was that's where they kill niggas.
Okay.
And here I am in Little Rock, Arkansas.
Right.
Doing an art show.
Right.
And all the art show that all the artwork I did had to do with the Little Rock Nine.
Okay.
And I met three or four of them.
Okay. Charlene Hunter Goss was one of them. I don't know if she was Little Rock.
She wasn't Little Rock Nine. No,
she wasn't
all.
That one. She was one of those others. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And see, this may be an uneducated brother, but I know the history of most of our black folks.
She went to
a school like, she went to a university.
Okay.
You know who else I talked to?
Who?
Ruby.
Bridges? Ruby Bridges.
She lives in New Orleans.
Okay.
I just saw her every now and then talk.
That's just too great.
That's the thing that made me feel good.
Yeah.
And then, now y'all, none of y'all probably know this. There's a man in Louisiana named Alton MacDonald.
Okay, who is that?
Alton MacDonald is a black man.
Okay.
See, they don't give him the credit that he deserves.
Okay.
He's the president of a black bank.
Okay.
There's a bank called Liberty Bank.
Okay.
There's some in Houston, and it's actually the biggest black bank in the country, in the United States.
Wow.
But they don't play on it because he's from Louisiana.
Okay.
Just like, remember the artist named John Biggers?
Yes.
He never got big like he was supposed to be.
Okay.
You know why?
Why?
Because he was from the South.
Okay.
That's all.
Let me ask you this. Any upcoming, now you just finished something for Juneteenth, and it was there somewhere near your home or at your home. You'd had an exhibit. What's upcoming? Anything upcoming that you want
to
mention?
The next thing I'm getting ready to do is in Atlanta.
Okay.
Black Medical Association. I do their show every year.
Okay.
Black doctors.
Is that in July or what?
August 1st. The
four. Okay. And that's in Atlanta. You do that every year. Any points that we have not touched on that you really feel you would like our audience to know about or hear about or that we just kind of skipped
over? All I want our audience to do is go out there and support artists of color.
Okay.
That's it.
Okay.
Goodbye, y'all. I'm leaving now.
All righty. Thank you for talking with us. Go forward and conquer. You already have.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye. Everybody. Wow. Frank Frazier. What a human being. What a delight to talk with him. Had so many astounding experiences. He keeps telling us that he was not educated, but boy, is he a wise person. Oh, what a joy. And, you know, that experience of him in Vietnam, it just kind of takes your breath away to imagine what he went through during that war experience and to watch his whole platoon get killed, and yet he survived. And I'm sure he must have wondered, why me? And maybe his life today and what he's been able to do with his life. And the way he has influenced other upcoming artists who look up to him so, and he never turns away from them. He is a certified mentor to other artists. Perhaps that was his purpose for being saved from that platoon and having to stay. He said he stayed in the hospital for a year and a half, recovering, learning how to walk, and he still bears, you know, some wounds from all those experiences. So, Frank Frazier, go on the web, look him up, look up his art, and I showed some of the images. Let me just kind of show those again. This was the Edmund Pettus Bridge image. that he did with the, you see the flag there, and it's black and white, and then he did the flags in color, and then he this is where is this one? This was one of his early pieces that he is very well known for the colors, the striking colors that he uses, and most Afrocentric. He's got a lot of art pieces like that. And then he very steeped, this is a more modern one with about Black Lives Matter, and very Afrocentric. And then this is the Panthers, but his use of art is in combination with what's going on in society. So he uses his art to express things going on in the world that he feels we need to know about. We didn't talk about the whole gun issue. Maybe one day we'll be blessed to have him back again, but that's certainly an issue that's going on right now, this whole gun violence and mass shootings and all like that. So we didn't get to ask him about that, but we're so thankful that he came on with us. We want to now talk about some of the, we just finished Juneteenth. Sunday, of course, was Juneteenth, and it was also Father's Day. And in my own memory of Juneteenth, I was remembering as I was growing up, I always heard these stories about the gatherings in Mahia, Texas. And I went back and just kind of looked up some of the history because, you know, things kind of begin to fade in your memory. But I just remember so we're going to talk a little bit about the gatherings in Mahia, Texas, and what caused them to just shut down. They had been the massive gatherings of our people in Mahia, Texas, for many, 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 many years, at a park there, and was just such a vibrant, celebrated thousands of us from all, you know, different parts of the nation would gather in Mahia. And then all of a sudden a tragedy happened in the early 80s, and it just shut down completely. And so I wanted to just kind of bring that forward a little bit now to remember it. And even the Texas Monthly Magazine did a write-up about it here recently. The writer was Michael Hall. And I just want to kind of review some of his research about the Mahia gathering of Juneteenth. And so it was gathered at Lake Mahia, which is a small body of water about 40 miles east of Waco. And it's known for bass fishing and crappie fishing. And fishermen and country folk would like to go there just for the peace and getaway time. And for generations, African-Americans used it, as I said, as a gathering place for this Juneteenth Jubilee. And we know that the history of Juneteenth is that the Union General came here to Texas and informed the enslaved people in Texas that they were now free. And so that's kind of how this, and that was in 1865, 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation had been signed by President Lincoln. So when this tragedy happened, it happened during a Juneteenth celebration in 1981. That was during the Ronald Reagan administration. So there was this gathering there on this particular day, June 19, 1981, thousands of African-Americans from, like I said, And the area was called Comanche Crossing, Comanche Crossing at Lake Mahaff. And it was several days, about 20,000 African Americans had gathered on that particular day. There were there was dancing and barbecuing and drinking red sodas and the traditional watermelon and meeting cousins that you hadn't seen for many until maybe probably the year previously. There were even worship services going on, just having a great time. And then part of the gathering was that annually they would reverently read the wording of the Emancipation Proclamation, which and a key line was all slaves are now free. So there they were. It was like a giant family reunion. But then there were these three African-American teenagers, and let's say their names. Anthony Freeman, Carl Baker, and Steve Booker. They were part of the celebration. Teenagers, African-American teenagers. They were smoking pot, but you know, hey, they were just hanging out, having a good time. But there were law officers there, two white officers and one African-American officer. They arrested these three black teenagers and put them in a little boat, in a small boat. Now, they were handcuffed. They handcuffed these three African-American teenagers. And so the three officers and the three handcuffed teenagers got in this small boat going toward the other part of the land. And the boat capsized. Now imagine that you've got three handcuffed teenagers, three officers who were not handcuffed. The three teens drowned. They drowned at that very crowded celebration. The officers made it okay. They were not handcuffed. So, there was pandemonium. After that, it became a national story. The New York Times sent down some reporters to cover it. The FBI got involved. The NAACP got involved. All came to this tiny town of Mahaff. But the officers were charged with criminal negligent homicide and also that they violated the Texas Water Safety Act. Now, the trial was moved three times because of the notoriety of it. And guess what? The trial finally was held in Dallas in the 80s. Now, as you can imagine, or maybe you can't imagine, but those officers were acquitted. No charges, got off scot-free. Now, they claimed that they had removed the teenagers' handcuffs. There's no evidence of that at all. And if they had removed the handcuffs, if the three officers survived, the three teens would have survived. Those teens drowned because they were handcuffed, but the officers were acquitted. Now, the families and the public were up in arms. They were devastated. They were angry. They were just incredulous that that had resulted. And, of course, it reminds you of the George Floyd incident. But guess what was missing? George Floyd was captured on social media. We had the visual of George Floyd. We did not have a visual of those three young black teenagers drowning. But the three officers were acquitted. And when I have a little more time to research, I'm going to research their names. I don't have their names right now, nor do I have what eventually happened with those officers. But they got off scot-free. And that shut down that decades of long decades and decades and decades and decades of celebration at Comanche Crossing in Mahia. Shut it down. No more celebration. Nobody wanted to even go to that area because the memories were so painful. And so then the area, the lake there was often vandalized. The grounds got to be overgrown with brush. The buildings began to crumble. Nobody wanted a part of it. That just ended that jubilant, very anticipated and joyful celebration that had gone on for so long. Of course, then by that time, Juneteenth had been declared a state holiday. Of course, we know now it has become a federal holiday, but it was declared a state holiday, but nobody wanted any part of the Mahia celebration. So then in 2015, an organization called the 19th of June organization tried to rejuvenate the celebration and tried to get the festivities going. They cleaned up the park a little bit and they formed a board. And they set up a bunch of rules and banning alcohol and increased law enforcement. They really were overrun with law officers at this celebration that they tried to revive in 2015. But it didn't go over too well. The public just thought, nah, too many police officers. We can't really have any fun. All they're doing is just, you know, policing everybody, looking over your shoulders. And still, police officers were a painful reminder of what had happened. So that attempt didn't really succeed too well. Then come on down to about a couple of years ago, about 2019, 2020, somewhere in that area. Well, I'll say right when the COVID situation started to manifest, there was still discussions about trying to get it going. But of course, the COVID problem got in the way, and there was no. Some people went there and they found signs that said no trespassing, no gathering at the park because of COVID, and so they turned around and found other ways to celebrate. There was also a high school alumni reunion going on in the area, so a lot of people just joined in with that parade and those festivities in the area. Some people wore T-shirts that were emblazoned with the names of what they began to call the Comanche Three, those three teenagers. And one shirt, for example, said, "Still remembering 40 years later." It was 40 years after that had happened. And so people began to wonder if there would ever again be a Juneteenth celebration at Comanche Creek. So then here this year, this same organization, after COVID, they, and of course, this is the Texas Monthly Reporter, Michael Hall, tells us that the group did a pretty good effort of trying to get some enthusiasm back up, and they did all kind of promotions, and they were to have performances, a jazz guitarist. It was going to be like a 3-day Friday, Saturday, Sunday event. And they would have jazz musicians, and they would have a parade of cars, and they would go along U.S. Highway 84, and then they would honor the three young black teenagers who were drowned, and the officers never prosecuted. They are known as the Comanche Three, and they decided they will place some plaques there at the lake, and they put up some temporary plaques just to give an idea of future things to come. And they also, there would be game players, cards and dominoes and volleyball and music and what have you. And then they would resume reading the Emancipation Proclamation, still trying to revive that very joyous, long, long time celebration. But they were cautious. They were optimistic, but they were cautious about whether it could really be revived. They were able to do a little bit. We'll have to get back with the organizers and get their impression of how successful they feel they were. But the hotels were there were a lot of people who, you know, got in the came to the Mahare hotels, you know, for the time period, and they even filled up hotels in little neighboring areas of Corsicana and Grosbeck. And they didn't have all of those police officers because they had learned a lesson from an earlier attempt. I think that was in 2015. So they didn't want to overpower people with all of that police force. But they did acknowledge that there had to be some rules and some regulations. And one of the organizers said this. He said, with the way things are today, there have to be rules and regulations. There could be no alcohol. And now they said that people could have some alcoholic beverages, but they couldn't walk around with the beer cans and all like that. They could put them in plastic cups because they were really trying to be as law-abiding as possible. And so they did hire private security. And they had some county sheriff's department people there. They said that they didn't want anyone to feel that they couldn't come and celebrate, that they wanted people to know, yet they wanted people to know that they would be protected there. And so they said they had learned a lesson that too much law enforcement was just too painful a reminder. And so, and here's another quote from one of the organizers. He said, we had to have the officers there. The way things are going in the country today, everybody's got a gun. And so one of the persons that was interviewed for the Texas Monthly Peace was the sister of one of the young men who drowned. The sister of Carl Baker, who was one of the young men, and his sister is now 61 years old, and she's, you know, a grandmother and all like that. Her name was Pamela Baker, and she, in the interview piece, she explained that she had been going to that celebration for decades and decades, and she remembers just growing up, going to Comanche Creek, running around, being with her friends, camping under the stars and dancing in the pavilion, and her family members congregating under a giant oak tree. And she said her family had picked out a particular oak tree that their ancestors way, way back in time, had picked this particular oak tree, and that was their site where their family would gather. And she said she remembered she carried on the tradition that her grandmother had. She would fry dozens and dozens of chickens and fry them for the family and for the friends and even for strangers who came up to them. But she recalled that all of that ended on June 19 in 1981 when her brother drowned. She remembered that her family was inconsolable. They just could not be consoled from the pain, And she said, but you know what? She decided that she would return for this year's celebration. And she said she knows it won't, probably will never be like it was before, but she wanted to come because there was going to be this ceremony honoring her brother, Carl Baker, and his two friends that lost their lives handcuffed, drowning in the lake. And so they gathered under that same oak tree, and she did the cooking of the chicken. And she said, it's going to be exciting to see how it turns out. And she says, as far as my family is concerned, we're just going out there to try to bring back some positive and joyful memories. But that's one memory that I had. I never went to Comanche Creek, but I was very, very aware of people just parading down there and staying for several days and just coming back telling all kinds of joyful Comanche Creek stories. But, you know, there's an old saying, you can't go home again. And even though they're trying to revive it, and maybe they will, but it will have to be a new addition, as that musical group named themselves the New Edition. This Comanche Creek, should it succeed, it will have to be a new edition with new goals, and I wish them well. I also wanted to talk about, now, and let me remind you, you are listening and watching. I was just thinking, and of course, I'm your host, Norma Adams-Wade, and you are my co-host. You know, co-host, y'all have brought me through a lot. You know, I don't know anything about this modern age of social media, but y'all know all of that stuff. So when we get snags, you co-host people, y'all help me through. But so we're talking about Juneteenth and some of the things. What all did everybody do? Did y'all go to, there was so much going on, oh my goodness, everywhere you turn, because of Grandmother Opal Lee, who's out of Fort Worth. She got us all just really hyped up because she was the power behind this national federal holiday coming to fruition, and President Joe Biden signing the law that brought that made it a federal holiday. And a number of people didn't have to go to work, and the kids, even though it was on the weekend, they had those who were in summer school, they had that Monday off and everything. So it was just all kind of stuff going on, rodeo and all kind of cookouts and all kind of walks, long walks and parades and celebrations and plays and musicals and, oh my gosh, everywhere you turn, Juneteenth, 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 and not just in Texas. Now, you remember that first it was a state holiday in Texas because Galveston, as you remember, was the site where General Gordon Granger read the notice to enslaved Africans who were here, letting them know 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation was signed that they were free. So that was in Galveston. So Texas became the site of Juneteenth. But I want to talk about some myths. Now, here's some more research that was done about myths related to Juneteenth, and throughout the nation now, not just in Texas, but since 1865, we know that African Americans, particularly in Texas, and then as Texans would move to other states, then the tradition would move to other states. But there are some research has been done that there are like four main myths about Juneteenth, and I found it rather interesting. Okay, myth number one. It says many enslaved people knew about Lincoln's executive order that emancipated them. Now, we're told that enslaved people, African Americans in Texas, had no clue. But this research says that many enslaved people in Texas knew about it because there was such a sophisticated grapevine system. And it says that many knew about it because as they were working in the kitchens and wherever the Anglos were, the slave owners were, they could hear them over, they could overhear them talking about it. And so it says many of them did know, and they would go back to the cabins and to the worship gatherings and whisper and tell the other enslaved people what they had heard. And so this research says that it's a myth that all enslaved African Americans in Texas 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation was signed, they did not know about it. So this research says, yeah, many, many of them did, and they spread the word. Now, that's myth number one. Now, myth number two says that, and here's a part that I, in my, what they taught me in school was that General Gordon Granger came to Texas with the Union Army, came to Galveston. Now, I remember specifically in my classroom being told that he was on a ship and that he stood on the the balcony or whatever you would call it of the ship and read this general order number three as the enslaved people gathered on the banks there of the river. That's what, excuse me, y'all, I'm going to blow my nose. As I told you, I'm fighting allergies right now. But that's what I was told. But now this particular research, which is called myth number two, and it says that generally educators say that Gordon Granger penned the wording of General Order 3 himself. And I wasn't taught that in school. I was taught that he just came and read a copy of the Emancipation Proclamation. So this is a different piece of information than what my classroom, when I was young and wet behind the ears, as in my classroom back a million years ago, that we were told. But anyway, it says that he didn't really write General Order number three, that one of his underlings actually wrote the wording of that order. And it said it included the language, all slaves are free and have absolute equality. And it says that this staff officer was named Major Frederick Emery. I never heard of him. But this particular research, which is supposedly destroying myth number two, says that he was staff officer was an abolitionist. Now, you know, the abolitionists fought to end slavery, and that he was from Kansas. And it says, as a crusader against slavery in Kansas, Emory was well versed on the subject of emancipation. Now, researchers said that Granger is just a character in the story, that he's not the great hero. Now, we were not really, again, in my classroom back when I was wet behind the ears, we were not told that General Gordon Granger was any kind of hero. We weren't told he was, we just thought he came, he was ordered to come here and read the order and let the enslaved people in Texas know that the Emancipation Proclamation had been signed 2 years earlier in 1863 by President Abraham Lincoln. So no, I never viewed Gordon Granger as any kind of hero. And it says that there has been some research that Granger was not as friendly toward enslaved people as we might want to believe, that some of in some of his official work, when he found prior to 1865, when he found runaway enslaved people, that he would send them back to the plantations they had escaped from. So that was myth number two. Now let's move on to myth number three. Yeah, now this is the one where I talked about the balcony. Now I heard a personality on TV the other day said that Gordon Granger came into Galveston with his troops on horseback. Now I'd never heard that one, but this one says that that he stood on a balcony and announced that, quote, all slaves are free. But this research says that he never, now I don't know about this one, I don't know whether I believe this myth buster or not, but it says that he never really read the order publicly, nor did any member of his staff. They said they just posted the order around town, particularly in places where African-American people gathered. And, of course, that would be churches. And then they mentioned one particular church being Reedy Chapel AME Church, which was known as the Negro Church on Broadway. But it was Reedy Chapel AME Church, and that was a particular place where they posted the order around. Now, again, you decide what you want to believe. So did Granger, first of all, did he come on a ship and read the order from the ship, and the enslaved people were standing on the shore listening? Was he standing on some other kind of balcony and he read it from some, I guess, hotel balcony or whatever? Or did his troops come riding in on horses and then just posted the order around town? You decide. You can do your own research and decide which one you want to believe. So that was myth buster number three. Now here's the last one. Okay, now it says the myth number four is that the Juneteenth order was basically a Texas version of the Emancipation Proclamation. But it, now here's where the myth buster part in. It says, but in fact, General Order Number 3 stated unequivocally all slaves are free, but it also contained patronizing language intended to appease the Anglo owners of our human bodies, the planters and the plantation owners, who did not want to lose their free workforce. So there were, it's this Mythbuster says that there were 41 words of the brief 93-word order that urged enslaved people to stay put and keep working. Now here are the words. Here are the words. These here's the wording. Quote, the freed are advised to remain at their present homes and work for wages. Wages? Okay, they've been given free labor all this time, so now they're going to suddenly start getting paid? Okay, let's read it again. The freed are advised to remain at their present homes and work for wages. It continues. They are informed that they will not be allowed to collect at military posts and that they will not be supported in idleness either there or elsewhere. Now, that definitely was some language to appease the Anglo owners. That was reading between the lines. Now, y'all are free, but you better stay where you are. But fortunately, it says that many of the enslaved people were no dummies. They were no dummies. And many of them, when they, even though they heard that part of the language that was written in General Order Number 3, that once they learned about it, that they hightailed it out of there. They hightailed it, and thanks be to the Almighty that they did. They just got on up out of there and went their various ways because the language, the message there was so clear. Yeah, y'all are free, but we're not letting you go anywhere. We want you to stay put. We're going to tell you we're going to pay you some money, but we were no fools. So those were four myths about the Juneteenth celebration that began in 1863. And we want to talk now about some of the things that are going on in Dallas. Now, I was just really uplifted to hear about this. For many years here, there's this group is called the Dallas Metroplex Musicians Association, and they have what they call a sacred choral music concert. Often they do it often. It's COVID kind of knocked it out for a while, but they have resumed now. So on Saturday, June 25th at 4:30 at Pearly Gates Baptist Church, they will have this year's sacred choral music concert. Now, Pearly Gates Baptist Church is located at 6021 University Hills Boulevard, 6021 University Hills Boulevard in Dallas. And the pastor is Dr. Thomas Payne. Now, here's what was so uplifting about this announcement, that the group is renaming the Sacred Music Workshop and concert, because they in leading up to the concert, they also have a musicians and choral workshop, and oh, it's just a fun thing. Singers and choirs get together, and they have a good time. They have the workshop, learn a lot of music and what have you, and then they give a concert. But they are renaming it for the founder of the concert, William S. Mitchell. Yes, so it has now been renamed in his honor. And so they're going to have a ceremony at this event to recognize the renaming of it. And the clinician for this year is the world-acclaimed professor, and I'm going to sabotage the name. Let me try to pronounce the name, out of Shreveport, who is the college professor. Let me try it. Natasha. That's the closest I can get. And let me spell it. NatorSHAU. Natasha, but I'm sure that's not the way you say it, but Davis. Out of Shreveport, a college professor and a music director, and has done clinicians for quite a while. And the event enables the group to give scholarships to students who are pursuing a musical career. This year they're going to give 5 scholarships. And so it's going to be a great thing. And the concert is free, y'all. It's free and open to the public. And now they do ask that you maintain the protocol. Where's my mask? They do ask that you maintain the protocol and bring your mask. Because we're going to do that, y'all. We're going to stick with it until we get it right. So they're asked that you maintain the protocol at the concert. So again, now that's Saturday, June 25. Now, let me just check my calendar. Okay, June 25, So that's this Saturday, okay? This coming Saturday. Today is the 22nd. So the 25th is this Saturday. So that's this coming Saturday, June 25, at Pearly Gates Baptist Church, 6021 University Hills in Dallas, 75241. Oh, and did I tell you the time? I didn't. 4:30 concert is 4:30. The Sacred Music Concert is at 4:30. And y'all, this is some good singing because I've been to this in the past. And it's the Sacred Choral Music Workshop and Concert. And it's at 4:30 this Saturday. And it's free. It's free, it's free, it's free. And the renaming ceremony will be during the concert. Now, I wanted to tell you about, do y'all know about Watermark that is now, it's a church. It's called Watermark Church, but they're now in the old Pearl C. Anderson School in South Dallas, right off of Elsie Faye Hagens and Robert B. Cullum over in that area. They have what they call a walk-up urgent care days, which are Mondays through Wednesdays. Every Monday through Wednesday from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. At the old Pearl C. Anderson School. And here's the address, 3400 Garden Lane. And the zip code is 75215. But you can walk up and you're encouraged to donate $10. But apparently they kind of look the other way if it's, you know, if you just really kind of need it. You don't have to have insurance. You don't have to show income. You don't have to show an ID. You don't have to have an appointment. There's no zip code requirement. And here's what all you can get. You can be treated for cough, cold, sore throats, fevers, ear aches, asthma, infections, minor trauma, lacerations, rashes, ear infections. Let's see, what else? Ear infections and even middle and high school, you can have a physical for your middle and high school sports activities. So this is here's what it's called. They call it the Watermark, let's see, what do they call it? The Watermark Urgent Care Mobile Clinic. That's what it's called. Watermark Urgent Care Mobile Clinic. That sounds like a pretty good deal, y'all. And again, they encourage you to make a $10 contribution, but if you just don't have it, you know, hey, they'll look the other way and give you the service. Walk Up Urgent Care, Mondays through Wednesdays. Did I tell you the time? 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. And again, it's in the old Pearl C. Anderson school, which is now owned by Watermark Church. And let me tell you the treatments again. And again, you don't need insurance. You don't need to show income. You don't need to show ID. You don't need to have an appointment. You don't have to live in the zip code. You can be treated for coughs, colds, sore throats, fevers, ear aches, asthma, infections, minor trauma, laceration, rashes, ear aches, ear infections, and you can even get you can get other tests as well, as well as the sports tests. You can get pregnancy tests. You can get lab work, and you can even get some counseling and referrals. You can even get counseling and referrals. That sounds like a pretty good deal, y'all. Go to the old Pearl C. Anderson building there in South Dallas. And that address, again, is 3400 Garden Lane, right off of Elsie Faye Hagens and Robert B. Cullum. That's a pretty good deal. Now, one other thing in the South Dallas area. And I want to give kudos to Ken Smith with the Revitalize South Dallas Coalition, because they keep the community informed about these different services in that area of South Dallas. But now this one is called the South Dallas Employment Project. So if you're looking for job training and support service while building your career, go to this South Dallas Employment Project, and over 100 Metroplex business partners come together and offer employment, job training, and support. So if you want more information about it, here is, let me just give you the website. I'll give you the website. It's the www.SouthDallasEmploymentProject.org. South Dallas Employment Project.org. And all of these 100 or so businesses come together and offer all kind of job opportunities and training, EMT, paramedics, landscaping, security jobs, office managers, customer service, truck driving, digital imaging, certification, solar technology. So you can get training and get a job. Get training and get a job. So that's a pretty good deal. Now, also, let me tell you about this one. I did mention this a little bit last week, but I wanted to tell it again. This is going to be fun. This is at the Black Academy of Arts and Letters, and about 400 students, mainly from Dallas Independent School District, mainly, and ages 10 to 18, they've been taking this performance activity this summer at the Black Academy of Arts and Letters downtown, founded by our own Curtis King. But this is the 38th annual Summer Youth Art Institute performance, and it's going to be the 24th, which is this Friday, and the 25th, which is this Saturday. So this coming Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 1 p.m. and 4 p.m., they will have this performance. The performance is $5, so you can go. But all of these young people, guess what they're going to perform? It's a full-scale production, what's called Erica Badu, the musical. It's a musical about our own Dallas-born performer. Everybody loves her, including myself, Erica Badu. What a talent, what a talent. So they're doing a, now, last year, I think it was last year, they did one on Beyonce. It was a performance about the music of Beyonce. So this year, it's a performance about the musical about Erica Badu, and it's based on her life and some of her more popular and celebrated music. The performances are $5, so y'all go, about 400 youngsters, and I've been before. They really entertain you, and they have a good time doing it. So it's the 38th annual Summer Youth Art Institute. So y'all want to go to that. Now, have you been paying attention to the Together We Dine activities? It's all based on bringing together various ethnic groups so we can get to know each other better. And, I think it's been going on about, 4 or 5 years in partnership with the Dallas Bar Association and the Together We Dine organization. What they do, again, you have conversation over dinner. Now, originally, you would gather and sit around a table and have dinner together. These people of various races and ethnic groups, and just kind of get to know a little bit more about your background, my background, your views on life, my views on life, your take on this, my take on that. And then, of course, when COVID hit, it went to Zoom, and they figured out a way to still have the diverse conversation and the diverse gathering on Zoom. Now, this one is, let me see now, is this one virtual? I know you sign up for it virtually, and I'm trying to look here at the small print. Yeah, it is. Okay. This one is also virtual, but this year it's virtual, and it's tomorrow. Tomorrow from 6:30, begins at 6:30, and you can go online and just have this wonderful conversation. And I think the way they do it is you bring your own dish or something wherever you are, but it's from 5:30 to 7:00. And if you want, let's see, where do you get more information? Where is the information, the login? Let me try to see. Okay. Well, you just go to social media and type in Together We Dine, and you'll see all the login information about it. But it's a pretty good conversation. And I think Mama Opal Lee is going to have some comments for this event as well. So we certainly want to listen to whatever she wants to say. Whatever she wants to say, we want to hear about it. And so it's a virtual event. Together We Dine. And, yeah, she's the main speaker. That's what it is. She's the main speaker. And so she's going to talk about her whole experience on this Juneteenth, starting with her long walks, and then media began to pay attention, and more people each time she would do her annual walk, more people would join in. And next thing we know, she was in D.C., and President Joe Biden was signing this order. But it was no easy task. It was no easy task, but she accomplished it. And I wanted to tell you about our friend that we've had here on, I was just thinking, Travis Wortham. And he has worked with Troubled Youth for a number of years. And he has written a book. I love the title. It's called What's Wrong with These Kids? And he spells it phonetically. The title of the book is, I'm not going to try to spell it, but he spells it just like with it. What's wrong with these kids? I'm going to blow my nose again, y'all. Y'all are my co-hosts. Y'all know what it's like to blow your nose. Okay, what's wrong with these kids? And then the subtitle is, are we creating monsters? Do you want to create monsters? Or raise champions, creating monsters or raising champions. And Travis Wortham knows what he's talking about because he's worked with troubled youth for many decades, and he's had a number of success stories. We're going to have him back on real soon because the man, he's informed about so many topics, and he stays on top of so many social events that are going on. So his book signing is this Sunday, June 26th, and it's from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. From 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. this Sunday. Where is it going to be? It will be at the Hall of State at Fair Park, 3939 Grand Avenue. Y'all know how to get to Fair Park, the Hall of State. You go in the Grand Avenue, which is Al Lipscomb Way now. It's 3939. The address inside the Fair Park is still 3939 Grand Avenue, but it's Al Lipscomb Way. And you go in that gate, and then you just go on in, and you'll be right there a few steps up at the Hall of State on your right. And so it's going to be there this Sunday, June 26th, from 3 to 5 p.m. And it's a lot of just really basic, solid, common sense, good advice on raising young people, raising healthy young people. And, you know, a lot of mistakes are being made in parenthood. There've always been mistakes in parenthood, but it seems like society has we've kind of lost our way in society these days. And you know, families, the family structure is dwindling, and you know that old trope about absent fathers and single moms having to struggle to raise the kids alone, and just all of the social traumas that particularly we as a people, but all people experience parental traumas. But, you know, then you have to factor in economic limitations, and then there's that whole argument about, are we teaching our kids social mannerisms and moral tenets? Are we teaching our kids morality, virtue and morality, and rules and regulations, and right and wrong? And are we teaching that? So Travis Wortham gives a lot of just common sense advice and observations in this book called What's Wrong with These Kids, Creating Monsters or Raising Champions. We're going to have Wortham back on. Travis Wortham Jr., I should say, because he has to honor his dad, Travis Wortham Jr., and he'll sign his book. So go out there, get a copy of the book, and you'll be better off for it. So we're getting ready to begin winding down. And again, we want to really thank our guests for today, visual artist Frank Frazier. What a life, what a person he has come to be, and so many experiences. And he has rubbed shoulders with just people. He says that he views them as, you know, ordinary folk, which is a good thing. Don't put anybody on a pedestal. But he says people like John Lewis, who he calls his personal friend, the late John Lewis. And we know that John Lewis was a civil rights warrior and icon. The word icon is attached to Frank Frazier's name as well. You know, an icon is someone that everybody looks up to. Martin Luther King certainly is an icon. John Lewis certainly is an icon. But young artists that Frank Frazier has mentored and continues to mentor, they call Frank Frazier an icon, and his art is just overpowering. I mean, he uses his art as social commentary. And he says in his talks, he says that, you know, he believes that that art should make a statement. He says he believes art should make a statement about the world, what's going on in the world, and it should carry a message, and it should kind of open your eyes. It should open somebody's eyes to what's happening around them. And again, of course, we know that one of the things that's happening right now is gun violence. We didn't get to talk to him about that, but maybe we can have Frank Frazier back on too. And maybe he may even do an art piece, may have already done one. He has many exhibitions, and he says he's getting ready to go to Atlanta to have an exhibition there. So as we get ready to to say goodbye and let you go out into the world and conquer, we always look at the message that Teddy Pendergrass gives us in his song, Wake Up Everybody. And we need to wake up. We need to wake up. Now, the conservative population, they're trying to make being woke be a negative thing, you know, and they ridicule individuals for what they say is being woke. They ridicule you. But we want to pay attention. We want to pay attention to the message about, and we're going to see if we can find Teddy's song, Wake Up Everybody, and listen to what he's going to tell us, if we can find it. And we know that he says, wake up everybody, no more sleeping in bed, no more sleeping in bed, no more backwards thinking. He says it's time to think ahead, time to think ahead, time to think ahead. He says the world has changed so very much from what it used to be. And let's see, we got to go the other way. Yeah, let's see, there we go. Yeah, I think we found Teddy. We found Teddy, so we want to go back and hear what he's going to say. Come on, Teddy, give us your message. Give us your message. He's going to give us his introduction. And he talks to the teachers, talks to the doctors, talks to the builders. Let's see, I'm trying to make the sound come up here. There he is. Tell us about it, Teddy. Time to think a new way. World has changed. Just that music, the background behind it.
Wake up everybody, no more sleeping in bed, no more back to thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much, what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Wake up all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. We just let it be. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it, girl.
We gotta change
you and me. Wake up all the doctors, make the old people well. They're the ones who suffer and catch all the hair. They don't have so very long. For the judgment day, the before they pass away. Wake up all the builders, time to build a new land. I know we could do it if we all lend a hand. The only thing we have to do is put it in our mind. Surely things will work out, they do it every time. The world won't get no better if we're just